Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Padkiri, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Yahya Shaukat. He's an urban researcher who specializes in housing policy analysis and strategies, data visualization, and historical mapping. With a focus on spatial justice and the right to housing, he co-founded the research studio 10 Tuba in 2014. Yahya is a regular guest lecturer and has published books and articles, including Egypt's Housing Crisis, The Shaping of Urban Space, published by the American University in Cairo Press 2020. It is this book that we will be discussing in today's conversation. Yahya, I'm very glad to have you here. Welcome to this interview.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Right. So let me begin by asking you a very basic question in terms of what your motivation was behind writing this book.
When you look at Egypt, you find that housing and the real estate market are a very big issue. However, very little has been written compared to how big this issue is. And maybe the last book that really comprehensively looked at it was published in 1996, so almost 30 years ago now. Otherwise, scholarly articles and books have focused on certain facets of this housing crisis, but very few have gone through a historic political analysis of it.
Right. So let me also ask you a question about some of the main methods that have been used in this work, because when I read it, it really, really seemed fascinating to me.
Well, for me, I'm trained as an architect and I practiced as an architect for 10 or so years before I started focusing more on policy analysis, research, and housing, affordable housing advocacy. So I'm maybe, compared to some other academics, a bit free from, let's say, discipline per se. So I was able to use many tools to try and get to an answer of some of the questions that I felt needed answering. So there's a lot of historic analysis, archival research, in newspapers, also firsthand accounts from many people that are affected by housing issues in Egypt. A lot of that came when I was a housing rights officer at a local rights organization. So a lot of the field work happened then with people that had grievances. So it's pretty much a mix of many different methods.
Right. Right. And of course, your book is about the question of housing. So let me begin by asking a very broad question that you can sort of enter into the discussion. How is housing in Egypt a socio-political phenomenon?
Well, it was interesting to find, because I mean, I was born in 1979, and since I could read and understand things around me, there has always been talk of a housing crisis. And this talk has not gone away in the last few decades, even though Egypt is probably one of the largest producers of housing per capita in the world. This production of housing or overproduction of housing has not led to a solution of this housing crisis, or what a lot of politicians actually like to term a housing problem. And for me, it was very intriguing. You had lots of cinema and writing in the 1980s and up until the early 90s about this housing crisis. Of course, scholarly work around the housing crisis, a lot of critique about housing policy, but nothing has really changed in terms of how governments have approached it. And then when I started looking more and more into the history of this, you find that it traces its roots back to probably the 1940s in this kind of modern urban context. And what I found was that every rule of Egypt, from the monarchy under British imperialism in the 1940s throughout the 1960s, which was this 50s and 60s was the socialist republic and post first post-colonial government, through the 1970s and a neoliberal government up till now. Every from the king and then every president since has associated himself directly with a public housing project. So you can see how this kind of patronal giving of housing to the poor has been associated with all these people coming from completely different and opposing political backgrounds, but they have this in common. So it's really something to look at.
Right. So you're talking about a very interesting part of housing. And in this context, if you could also throw some light on how housing becomes a crisis in Egypt, as the title of your book describes.
Well, it has been the same thing really from the 1940s, and you find the first kind of policy papers and research written about how to go about it. And the main thing that that architects and put their finger on then was this big gap between what housing costs and what people can afford. And this has really been the case. If you look at earlier projects from the 1920s and 30s to build social housing, the people behind it were always frustrated at how what they built, however much they tried to bring the cost down, was still too expensive for the poorest people to actually pay even to cover the cost of it. And this was really liberal thought, is that the provision of housing had to cover its costs. And it was only in the mid-1940s when the architect Mahmoud Riad wrote a paper about how there should be a subsidy for this housing to bridge this gap between how much the housing costs and how much people can actually afford to pay. And Egypt has always been notorious for very low wages. And therefore, however much they brought the costs of housing down, it was still too expensive. So this first idea of subsidizing the housing, but with the government paying this gap between what people could afford and what housing actually cost to build, was put forward. And was tried in 1950 with the first, let's say, large housing estate. But then very quickly, the Socialist Republic was established and put this into the mainstream. So it was only really in the 1950s that you started having housing that was affordable to, let's say, a big part of the population. But then again, we see a regression of this in the late 1970s with the neoliberal regime, is that instead of renting the houses out at affordable prices that are related to the wages, they started selling the housing again at the cost of the housing. And here we see how much more expensive it became, and you start to find many sort of critiques and commentary from people trying to apply to the housing and not being able to afford it. And this exists still today. Today, social housing is sold to applicants under a subsidized scheme, a subsidized mortgage, but this is still very expensive for really the poorest of the poor that actually need this housing.
Right. So how are these houses acquired as well as designed, and who are the primary stakeholders?
Well, I think since the 60s, we've had the Ministry of Housing, which is a national level ministry that oversees the social housing production. But overall, this is one of three main players. So the government is one player in terms of the social housing, that you have the private sector, the formal private sector that get permits and build on land that has been designated by the government as urban land and they can build on. And then you have the informal sector, which is everything from owner-occupier families mid-scale developers that build without getting a permit and usually on agricultural land. This latter form has been the biggest producer of housing in Egypt since statistics can tell us, which is from about the 1960s or 70s till today. And more or less they produce, especially around urban areas, they produce about 50% to 60% of the housing on average. This has started to come down a little in the last few years with big government crackdowns on informal housing. And at the same time, the government itself has scaled up the building of social housing or government-built housing. So now it's starting to tip more in the favor of government-built housing. With this formal private sector, which is usually the main producer of housing in many countries, the smallest now of the three. And this is really a big imbalance because this is where a lot of the money and investments are, and this should be more or less how housing is built. And I'm not necessarily talking about big developers, but even self-built housing, if we can call it private as opposed to the government built, but for it to be formal. And there's no avenue for this. There is very little, if any, government-sanctioned land that can be sold to individuals or families. The government has recently been selling exclusively to registered developers. So, and in many cases, the government has very rarely designed land in cities or towns for individuals to build themselves or families to build themselves. And this is really the kind of historic traditional method in most of Egypt. So with this kind of ignoring that demand, it has led to that very big part of society being informalized. And at the same time, this kind of formal, between quotations, private sector is really geared to the upper middle classes and upper classes. So it's a lot of luxury housing and very expensive housing, leaving only the government to supply housing that is supposed to be affordable. But even then, I do not think, and based on my calculations, it has not been able to cover more than half the demand, even less, from groups that cannot afford the formal private housing.
Right. So you did talk about the government. Do you think that there are some shifts in the way the Egyptian government's policies on housing have been made? And if yes, what would be some of the major shifts that have happened?
Well, the major shift that I've been seeing over the last few years is that the government has now expanded its housing to not just be, let's say, for low income or middle income, but also higher incomes. So it's gotten into this kind of luxury and upper middle class housing. And this is very intriguing at a time when it's being more liberal in a lot of other let's say, social services like health and like education, it's been more keen to go into the real estate industry. And in many ways, it's not a strategic industry unless it's just about providing subsidized housing or affordable housing, but it's not really. So a big portion of the housing that is government built today is actually not affordable. And in this time, this may shift again over the next few years for it to go back to affordable housing. But this can only be helped with the mortgages that it gives, which are subsidized because the interest rates in Egypt are very high. You can't, as a private person going to a normal bank, it's very unaffordable to get a normal mortgage. Interest rates in Egypt are now over 12%. So the subsidized mortgages are now 3%. So it's a huge difference. But these are only allowed for certain housing of certain prices and for people that meet certain criteria. So it's like these two markets of housing, if you like. But again, this is a lot of money to put into that without going to the core problem of housing, which is basically that land and housing materials are just becoming more and more expensive because of this speculative nature. When I first started talking to you, I told you that Egypt is one of the biggest producers, and this really has killed this mantra of demand and supply, is that there's a huge supply of housing, but it's of a certain price and a certain nature that many people can't afford it. But what this does is it produces vacancy. So you have a lot of ghost towns and a lot of empty housing that has utilities, that has water and electricity hooked up to it, but no one's living in them or using them. And they're just used as a form of investment and even pension funds for people that bought them. Whereas there are many that need the housing to live in them, but they can't access them. So this again is being reproduced by these mechanisms that see housing as the main investment and the main protector against rising inflation and a lot of economic ills.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. So what do you think about the rental markets in Egypt? I mean, have they evolved in any way from the 20th century?
Well, throughout the 20th century, I think since World War II, there has been this rent control, which in Egypt we call old rent, where anyone that had a contract would have basically a rent freeze and the rents would not rise. And this was at first an emergency measure because of the war and because of the housing shortage, but then very quickly it became permanent and was actually bolstered by the socialist government of the 50s and 60s. And this lasted till the 1990s, where big reforms brought in or liberalized the market. They didn't annul the old contract, so you still have people under the old contracts, the rent frozen contracts, but then any new contracts would be completely free for landlords to set the prices and for them to rise. But basically what it did is a massive deregulation of the market. There is no real anything that tells you where rents are supposed to be, by how much they should rise. It was really the antithesis of this rent control. And at the same time, it's rent control has its ills and has its problems, but then also this very deregulated market has its own problems, making rental very much unaffordable for many people. So at the end of the day, in the beginning, when it was enacted, it helped a lot of people rent. But then very quickly, as prices rose, you find that the amount of renters in Egypt has really flattened out. And in real terms, there aren't many new rental apartments. Everyone wants to own their homes, or when they get married, they still live with their parents. But for new households to live in rental housing, it's now seen as a temporary step before they could afford a home. But households always feel insecure in rental because the rental rights are very lightly enacted. Also, landlords homeowners don't really want to rent their homes out because they also feel that the government won't protect them if renters don't pay. So it's a very tense market where most people that rent have some sort of physical control of the home. They know that they can evict someone if they don't like what they're doing, if they don't pay. So there's some legitimate acts of evictions, but there's also a lot of illegitimate act of eviction. A lot of it affects single women who are always looked down upon and always victimized in these power relations with landlords, with minorities, with students. So landlords usually pick people that they feel are weaker than them to rent out to, because this gives them some sense of security that they will be able to control their homes. And this is really a big problem. And this is why there's a lot of vacancy, is that a lot of people don't want to go through this, and the housing is there and it's very good. It's very good condition, but it's not rented out.
Right. So how would you describe the nexus that exists between real estate developers and government agencies?
Well, real estate developers, especially let's say the really big ones, have tended to be or are ones that have grown under the previous the regime under Mubarak. This was a regime that lasted about 30 years. It had a ring of businessmen around it that benefited a lot from being close to the government. A lot of these developers were able to get land from the government at very low prices. And this really catapulted them business-wise. And they remain some of the strongest businesses today, even though that regime doesn't exist anymore and these perks aren't around anymore. So this has really been a boost to a certain few. And with them came also pressure on policy in these so-called new cities that are coming up around Cairo, in the desert around Cairo, where they control big parts of land in them. And with them have been able to build and sell housing that is very expensive, but also to control it. So they control these compounds or gated communities. So even after they sell the homes, people living there live more or less like tenants, where these companies control utilities, control security, control maintenance, control the services inside, like the clubs, even provide now schools and shopping and administrative uses. So it's like a running business. It doesn't end just at selling the unit. And this has been really lucrative. We did a recent study on this market, and we found that about the top 10 listed real estate developers, 50% are owned by non-Egyptians through the stock market. So this means that this real estate market is very much internationalized, and this gives a very big disadvantage for local residents against this huge international market, is that there's a very big gap between the buying power, and the market will always seek more and more growth of profits at the expense of affordability. And again, this is another case of this deregulation of the housing market and very little controls on making it affordable for the masses.
Right. Also, what role does the idea of the beautification of the city play in Egyptian policy making?
I mean, this this vision of the beautiful city or beautification of the city has existed, I think, since even the 1920s or 30s, and where a lot of planners and officials have always not liked the way Cairo looked. Yes, it has a very big poor population, and very big parts of it, of the housing, was either in poor condition, so it used to be, let's say, beautiful between quotations and well built, but over the time deteriorated. And then with the from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you had the informal settlements rise, where people cut costs by not painting the facades, and for a lot of people, this became the ugly part of the city. And there have been many initiatives by the government to either demolish these places and build designed or planned housing in their place. And when that was not very viable, then they started to give in and say, well, we'll just paint over them. So you have these places that are all painted in the same color for kilometers along the ring road and the highways. And yes, so it's always been this, it's always irked politicians how Cairo looks. And it's just a kind of a shell, basically, of what is behind this. And very little has been done to sort of address why really it became, between quotations, ugly. And yes, so we have this this role. It's been very central, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Right. Last question. Could you also talk a little bit about the scope of future research in this field?
Well, I think the future is more of looking into the past and how we got here, and it's a very in many ways it's predictable where this is going to go, is that affordability isn't going to happen anytime soon, and people will continue providing themselves with housing in the ways that they can, with the means that they can. However much this is cracked down upon, it will still happen, because ultimately you have millions of families that that need to be housed, and the solutions out there and the what is offered out there is not within their means or culturally appropriate. So we will continue to have this tension until something really deep is addressed in how housing is built. So I see more of this. I see a continuation of the new cities being built, though especially with gated communities, proliferation of them. But I also see this risk of the real estate market continuing. And you've always had these kind of bubbles and bursts, and very little in the way of avoiding them. So it's what I see is really more of the same. It's just the scale of it is different. It's not very different future.
Right. Thank you so much, Yahya, for this wonderful conversation. It was a pleasure listening to you. It was such a pleasure listening to you talk about your book. And I hope that our listeners go back and buy a copy and read the book. Those who have already read it, I hope you reread it after the perspectives that the author himself has thrown our way. So thank you once again, Yahya.
Okay, and thank you for having me.